This is Ryan Fitzpatrick, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 20 of the Neil Reynolds Podcast. This week, it's a little bit different. So I'm going to catch up with a friend of mine, an old friend, Jerry Anderson. And for American listeners, the name may not be familiar, but he's done so much for the sport in the UK. Jerry played as an amateur, played for the Great Britain team. He played professionally for the London Monarchs. He went on to coach youth teams and do a lot for grassroots American football. He now works for the NFL on the football operations side. So you might wonder why we're kind of speaking to him, but he's done so much for this sport in the UK. And as many of our listeners will be aware, October is Black History Month. So I wanted to acknowledge that by closing out the month by speaking with Jerry and giving him a platform to tell his story and all that he has achieved in our sport in the month when he's been honoured by NFL UK.
It's funny, Neil, I thought I've always just gone about and done what I needed to do and always thinking about the next man up kind of scenario. But when I actually took a stop and thought about it, I felt very proud. Sometimes you don't realise what you've actually achieved until you look back. It's like putting your CV together. You know, you're in a job for years and you have different experiences. And the only time you realize how much experience you have is when you take a stop to update your CV. So for me, this was one of those moments when I realized that, well, I've done a lot and I've been lucky with some of my experiences. But at the same time, there was a lot of hard work involved.
Yeah, and you do cover off so many avenues, you know, playing in the amateur game, coaching in the amateur game, playing in the professional NFL Europe. You've been on Sky with myself. You've now worked in football operations for the NFL. You're kind of a mentor for NFL Academy. So lots to get into. You're right. When you list it all out, it's fantastic achievements. Let's start at the beginning. When did you first become aware of the NFL? And was it sort of love at first sight or did it have to grow on you?
No, I think the first time I recall seeing NFL football was on a show called World of Sport back in the 70s. And they used to show the highlights of the Super Bowl. It used to be the Raiders, the Steelers, the Cowboys. And I just loved the excitement. I loved the excitement. I loved the physicality. And I just saw it as a challenge. And, you know, at that time, you know, I was like, 12 years of age maybe. Sport was what I did. If there was a season going on, I was playing sport somewhere, be it football, cricket, rugby, whatever it was, basketball, I was involved. And at that time, you know, you think, oh, it's a nice sport. Love to get into it, but that may never happen because it's American football, right? And it has that tag. At that same time, I fell in love with the Raiders because I just liked their attitude. It was like no nonsense. You know, we'll just, this is us and take it or leave it. So that was my first experience. And then as, you know, I started to be able to stay up and watch Super Bowls and everything else, you know, I liked the way that the 49ers, Bill Walsh, you know, the way his offense went about their business attacking defenses. Yep. And I just loved it. And the more I got into it, I just loved the thinking process behind it, you know, and realized it was a much mental game as it was a physical game.
And it was, we have a lot of listeners on this podcast from America as well as the UK. And maybe they don't understand necessarily. Back in the day, we had to work really hard to become passionate fans of the NFL, didn't we, Jerry? You had to dig around to find your football content. Not like now, but you really had to be invested in it.
Oh, you definitely had to be. You know, you'd watch one Super Bowl and you make plans and you put the next year's Super Bowl in your diary. You organise your work life, your work schedule around it because you want to make sure that you watch it live. You have a nap in a Sunday afternoon because you know it's not going to kick off to like midnight, 1 o'clock UK time. And you'd stay up and you watch the whole game. And that was it. And then, you know, back in the early 80s, Channel 4 came up with a highlights package, and that really brought it to the fore. You know, at that time on TV, it was like the program called Songs of Praise,
yep,
or it was American Football. And, you know, we only had like four channels at that time. And a lot of people got involved in American football in the UK because of that highlight package show. You know, realize the excitement. It was something new, and it was almost fashionable to be playing American sports.
When did you start playing the amateur game? And this is another thing for our American audience. We paid to play the game over here. You know, and I was a tight end. Jerry, you were a tight end. That's where the comparison ends, because you went a lot further in your career than I ever did. But we both played the same position, and we both paid to play to start with. So when did you start playing as an amateur?
December 1985.
Okay.
I think I could remember. I think it may have been about December the 8th, something like that. It was a Sunday. I was having a conversation with one of my best pals, and he said his brother went to try for American football. I was like, what, American football in the UK? I'm game. Went and practiced up at Streatham Common with a team called Streatham Olympians. And at the time, I thought it was a new sport. You know, it's the first time in. I went around, ran around as a receiver. I had a basketball background, so I could catch. So I was a big receiver, and it was a whole lot of fun. What I didn't realize was that they were entering like their third season, and they were one of the better teams in the country at the time.
And so was that pressure then? Did that feel like some pressure as you went into that?
Neil, you know what? It was just sport. It was just another sport I could play. And that was it. You know, at that time, you know, I'm just thinking about learning the game. I'm having an opportunity to play a game that, you know, if you think back to 12, 13 years before, whatever it was, or eight, whatever the time was, I never thought I'd going to get an opportunity to play American football. Okay, and it lies in the name American football. That was the mindset then, that it's never going to be in the UK. And here I am, age 20, being able to actually try and learn how to play the game.
And so you played a long time then at amateur. So what, take us through the process of becoming a London Monarchs player, or England Monarchs. So London Monarchs first, then they were the England Monarchs. So you've been an amateur for a while then before you went pro.
Yeah, I mean, in comparison to, you know, when they go pro in the States, I was an old boy when I played for the Monarchs. I was a veteran age without the experience, let's say. Yep. So I started with the Olympians at age 20. I played for 10 years, and before I got the opportunity to try out for the Monarchs, and was successful in making the team in 95. Now, in that time span, our team, the Streatham Olympians, became London Olympians and became like one of the powerhouses of Europe. You know, we went to three Euro Bowl championships back to back, and we won two of them. And we were like a dominant team, the first British team to win the Euro Bowl. And I think in a way that raised my profile, because I was playing on a great team. The Monarchs came around for the second time around following they shut it down after the 92 season. And I went to try out at Southwark Park with hundreds of other individuals. And they had a rule then that, you know, seven of the team had to be national players, which meant they had to be from the market the team was going to be based in. And thankfully, I was one of those, having basically completed the combined testing and everything else. I got an opportunity to become London Monarch.
So as you went into that and playing professional football, then you're playing against guys that are coming over and being allocated from the NFL. Did you have a different mindset let's say if you were doing that at 21 or 22, you might have been thinking, okay, this could be a pathway to the NFL. That comes with certain pressures. Did you just enjoy it for what it was, that you just got an opportunity to play professional football towards the end of your career?
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. Neil, I'm a T-shirt and shorts guy, and it gave me that opportunity to be in a T-shirt and shorts like every day at practice. You know, from practice, and then you finish practice, put T-shirt and shorts, and I've gone to meetings, and that was me. I'm very comfortable in that. My mindset was I'm going to enjoy it for what it was. I didn't know where it was going to take me, but as I got more involved in it, I realized I wanted to stay in football in some capacity. I didn't know what that was going to be at the time, similarly to me not knowing whether I was going to play American football. But I just wanted to put myself in a position where if an opportunity came up, you know, I'd be considered as somebody they'd use. And so what I'd do You know, when we had like personal appearances that the monitor wanted to do, I'd throw my hand up and go and not worry about whether I was getting paid or not. The other guys were like, well, if I'm not getting paid, I'm not going. I was like, yeah, send me, I'll go. And I, you know, and it worked. I think still being involved, it's worked out in my favour, to be honest.
So switching to play football professionally, the 1995 season would prove to be a defining one for Jerry. The Monarchs team he played for had a coach in Bobby Hammond who was renowned for being tough. And there were a group of players who'd moved over from America to compete in the league. They were a long way from home, while Jerry was living in Crystal Palace in very familiar surroundings. So was there a culture clash? Was there a European-American divide?
It was a major learning experience. You know, from going to be the best at your position in Europe to being just another football player, and realising that what I knew wasn't enough. How I, my ability to play the game wasn't enough, and how I'd have to not reinvent myself, but go to work again to improve, to show that I can play. So I think there was a certain stigma attached to the national players.
Yeah.
Okay, we're playing an American sport. And I say American sport because that's how it was presented to us. And for some of the coaches, you know, they gave us no love, they gave us no respect. But for the players, it was different. Some of them didn't respect us, but some of them helped us untold times. You know, they made sure that we knew what our assignments were. You know, because one of the things I struggled with was learning the information or transferring the information into plays that I knew. I mean, the formations were the same, but they called them differently. The plays were the same, but they called them differently. So how do I translate the information that they want me to learn into what I already knew? And what we used to do after practice, and the tight ends, receivers, we'd go to someone's room or dining hall, and we'd put down chairs to create the scenario of like each play. And, you know, they'd have me going in motion. They'd call out the play, I'd go in motion if I had to, and then I'd walk my route. And this was how they helped me develop my sense of the playbook and understanding the playbook. So learning how to study, you know, going from playing for one of the best teams in Europe where we practice maybe three times a week to professional level when I'm practicing twice a day, it's a totally different learning. And coupled in those two-a-day practices, you've got two meetings to go to, you've got to lift. If you need treatment, you need to go and get treated. You know, you can't go to practice without being strapped up ankle-wise or wrist-wise. And if you get injured, if you haven't got taped up and you twist an ankle, you get fined for it. So it's learning all these disciplines, whereas, you know, as amateur, you just walk up and play. You walk up and practice. So it was a different beast. And then you're playing against guys who recognize what's going on and they react so much quicker. So, you know, we talk about the speed of the game. You know, yeah, I can compete from a physical standpoint in terms of my quickness and how quick and how fast and strong I was. But the way they diagnosed plays, so they just reacted so much quicker that I was always half a step behind in the early stages. And it was a grind. I mean, I was in great shape going into training camp. I'll never forget. I thought, yeah, this is me. I'm good. The third day of practice, the last practice day, I couldn't walk. I was shuffling off the field. A shuffling. And I went in to see our trainer. Our head trainer was James Collin, who's now the chief medical guy at the LA Chargers.
Yep.
And, you know, he said, London, because that was my nickname, go and stand in a barrel of ice outside the training room. I said, what? He said, yeah. And so it took me about 12 minutes to be able to stand in this ice up to my waist. I mean, every time I put my foot in, I take it out. It was just painful. But I tell you what, I stood in there for 10 minutes and I was golden. I came out, I was like, wow, I'm ready.
Good to go again. Good to go.
No, totally good.
Tell our audience, how many years did you play for the Monarchs?
I played two seasons for the Monarchs.
Okay, so 95 was, and 96. Yeah, so 96, was that the fridge year?
Yes, it was.
So William the Refrigerator Perry, one of the most famous players for fans of the 80s, obviously defensive lineman for the Chicago Bears, played one season. Well, not quite one season, did he, Jerry?
not quite one season.
No, it was obviously a bit of a marketing thing. What was he like? What was that whole experience like?
he was real cool. You know, understand, when I started playing American football, you know, it was the year when the Bears were so dominant. You know, and it was, you know, my first practice session as an amateur was, 4 weeks before the Super Bowl. So fast forward to like 11 years later, and here's the man who scored that touchdown. And while you're not in awe of him, you respect him for what he's done and the athlete he was. And initially you're thinking, because he's not staying with the team, oh, okay, he's going to be like that. But when he came to practice, he was just a regular guy. He was funny. He was an educator. There was no airs and graces about him. He came in as a teacher, and you could see he was always trying to coach the guys, especially the D-line he was working with, and how to get better, which was great for us. It was great for morale and also very entertaining, obviously.
For those of you who aren't or weren't fans of NFL Europe, the London Monarchs and the Amsterdam Admirals enjoyed a fierce rivalry. But when the Monarchs and their American contingent visited the Dutch capital with Jerry within their midst, they had, well, let's just say they had an interesting time.
It was a bit of an experience for them, a bit of an eye-opener, I think, for them. And, you know, you're dealing with young people, young men who really haven't travelled in their lifetime. You know, they're early 20s and they've grown up, they're born and raised and grown up in a certain area, and they really haven't ventured maybe no further than a mile or 2 miles out of where they've grown up for the duration of their lives. And now, you know, the first thing they're thrown across the pond, as they call it, so it's the first time they've travelled. And then you take it somewhere like Amsterdam where things were a little bit more liberal, and they're like, London, can I get? And I'm like, well, yeah, that's your shout. I mean, we had guys who wouldn't leave our training complex, go to Amsterdam and lose their minds. And I say lose their minds because it was such a shock to them.
Right.
You know, the cartoon character you would draw up would be of somebody like with two big beady eyes just popping out of their heads.
Yeah.
You know, and it was comical. I mean, a couple of guys got left behind. You know, they didn't make the bus. It was a great time.
We'll be back with more from Jerry Anderson after this short break on the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Hi, I'm Bruce Arians, and you're listening to the Neil Reynolds Podcast.
Welcome back to the Neil Reynolds Podcast and my chat with Jerry Anderson. Now, before the break, we heard about some of the shenanigans when the Monarchs visited Amsterdam. Not sure Bruce Arians would have approved of that, although actually, knowing coach, he might have been leading the celebrations. NFL Europe had more to it than that, of course. It was a professional league that helped propel the likes of Kurt Warner back to the NFL. And from one legendary quarterback to another, Jerry has fond memories of playing with Preston Jones.
He's the guy who threw me the ball for my first and only professional touchdown. Again, you know, I was lucky that I think when I played, I worked with some good quarterbacks and some good people, you know, just thankful that they were able to be patient and help me get better. And when Preston threw in the ball, it was almost like a surreal moment. Everything slowed down. You know, you hear the stories about when the ball's coming to you, how slow it becomes. Literally, yeah. For me, it was so slow. And then I called it and I thought, I scored a touchdown. Now what do I do? You know, that's the whole process. And I remember T-Wiz came up to me and the guys were coming up to me. And I was like, oh, I've scored. And I was like, yeah. But I'll never forget. One of my greatest moments, obviously. I mean, everyone wants to score as a professional. And again, you know, I'm lucky enough to have achieved that.
That's great. It is brilliant. And the fact you didn't really know what to do was all part of it. It was like, yeah. It was just part of the celebration. We're very lucky, Jerry, to have worked around NFL UK. We get around some real legends of the game. It was interesting then when you just said about quarterbacks that were patient with you. In all the people, you think of people that we've had over, Jerry Rice, Joe Montana, the only person I've ever got an autograph from, because he was a real favourite of mine. I used to sit in the stands and watch him, and I got him to sign a cue card that I had on stage at the Trafalgar Square fan rally, was Brad Johnson. Right. Love Brad Johnson.
Class. Brad Johnson was class all day long.
Yeah.
All day long. I remember we were When I say we were, it was myself, Rowell, and Steve Hutchison. You know, they'd moved the meeting time up, and we didn't know. And we got there into the meeting room, and we were late. And head coach Bobby Hammond sent us out of the room.
Oh, no.
And we said, okay. And, you know, like I said, I was one of the older ones, so I understand that for every reaction is a reaction, and that, you know, you have to be responsible. So we get fine. It's no big deal. About 5 minutes later, Brad turns up with Jim Ballard. They didn't get the memo that the meeting had moved up. So we're outside just chopping the breeze, just talking stuff. And, you know, the next day I go to head coach and say, oh, okay, coach, I understand you're going to fine me. What is it? He goes, oh, it's okay. Said, what do you mean it's okay? I said, no, I've got to pay. He goes, no. And then I realized that Brad, obviously being the starting quarterback, also being late, highlighted the fact that maybe the communication between the staff and the players wasn't the best. But Brad, he was golden. As you see him now, that's exactly how he was. There was no ears of graces. He was there about the football. He was there about trying to make it back to the NFL. And I'm glad he got the opportunity. And I think that's the thing about NFL Europe at that time, Neil, that those who understood what it was about, you know, and put the work in, got another opportunity. Those who were disappointed that, you know, the places where we stayed weren't like being back in the NFL, you know, they still had what I call delusions of grandeur, so didn't apply themselves, they didn't get the opportunity. You know, and there's something in that, you know, when I speak to the kids I coach, I'm like, it's all about the grind. It's all about being committed, and it's all about being disciplined, being committed to that discipline. Because what it does, it doesn't guarantee you anything. But it makes sure that you, if the opportunity arises, that you're ready to take it. You know, you're preparing for something that may never ever happen. But you want to make sure that if it does happen, you're ready.
After you played professionally, you went back to the amateur game coaching. You know, the London Cobras dominated the youth and junior scene for a number of years. From that came the London Warriors team that has dominated the adult game here now for the past decade or so. But that wasn't just about X's and O's, was it, Jerry? I mean, tell our listeners about the thinking behind setting up that program.
You know what, Neil? At the time, I wasn't thinking about setting up any program. You know, I was a London Olympian through and through. And, you know, I still am, regardless of the situation, I still am. And I'd go down to a practice. I went down to a practice December 2004. I see, like, about 20-odd kids running around. Some had equipment, some didn't. But they were going at it full pelt. And there's a coach, a junior coach, Jeff O'Driscoll, love him to death. He's been coaching junior football for as long as I can remember. And he was recognised at the Hall of Fame for his commitment to junior football. I mean, he's been around for a long time. He was there working with these kids. And then I went back again in March, and it was like the same group of kids working hard, same situation ain't changed. Some of the London Olympians players were coaching them before they went to practice. But as the senior season drew closer, those coaches couldn't put in the time. And I just happened to be around at the end of that practice where a conversation was had between the owner of the Olympians, the GM of the Olympians, and Jeff, and talking about, you know, the kids need to pay a deposit next week, because if they don't, they won't be entered into the league. And my first thought was like, swear. These kids have been working on it for like 4 or 5 months. Now, if we're going to have that conversation should have had them while the kids were here, so they fully understand, rather than allow Jeff to have that conversation singularly. And if you knew Jeff, if he had the money, he'd have paid it for all those kids. That was just his thing. So I got involved in coaching the London Olympians juniors at the time. You know, I was annoyed, frustrated, by everything else. And I remember having a conversation with Alistair Kirkwood the next day and explained to him the situation. And apparently what it was, that those group of kids I'd seen playing was a combination of 3 or 4 teams, junior teams who didn't have enough players to be individual teams. So they came together to make one. And basically what it was, you know, the decision was made, okay, let's support them. How can we support them? You know, we had a program back in the day where people want to start youth and junior teams. We would loan them equipment. They would then apply for the waterfall grant. And then when they purchase equipment, they'll give that equipment back to us so we could continue using equipment to to grow the game of junior contact football. Went down to Crystal Palace, brought out shoulder pads and helmets, and anyone who didn't have, we were able to kit up the first practice. Now, this was 3 weeks before the season started, so we didn't have much time. Got some good people involved. Coach Tony Allen, who is now at the NFL Academy, his son Jerome, who was a quarterback playing flag football at the time, and just a few others. Will Bryce was one of the players who's now our lead in player development. We went down there, went down to some coaches, put the shoulder pad helmets on these young people, and they started to go at it full pelt. And lo and behold, somebody breaks their collarbone. And I'm in my mind, I'm thinking, we're done. The first time you put shoulder pads, helmets on these kids and they know exactly what it's like, we're done. There's no way I see this, you know, these kids sticking around. Anyway, with that in mind, I had to make a decision about the safety of the kids. I called up Baffa and had a conversation with, Baffa at the time. And I explained to him that, listen, this situation, we've just got involved with these kids. Someone's popped their collarbone. And we're due to play our first game in 3 weeks. From a safety standpoint, you know, I have to concede the game, or we have to concede the game. But if we do that, I also understand that you have a policy that if you don't complete your season, you can't make the playoffs. And I said to him, if these kids can't make the playoffs, I think the program's going to shut down because what are they playing for? Mm. Thankfully, you know, they listened. Wendy, Simon, Angie Atkins, they listened. And they said, okay, they understood. And they allowed us to compete. What came next, Neil, was unbelievable. Unbelievable. That first year was very emotional for me as an individual in terms of what these young people taught me about myself and the type of character that I can be and ultimately am. We went undefeated. We were destroying teams. I mean, these kids came to practice and I've never been, apart from the Monarchs, I've never been around a program where attendance was up in the high 90s. I'm talking about maybe 98% for every practice. And these kids, they came from everywhere. We had Basildon, Milton Keynes, Ellsbury, Watford. They came. They came. And the mix was so vast. We had kids going who went to Dulwich College, mixing with young people who were helping mum to bring up their other siblings. And these are like 16, 17-year-old young people. Mm. And when they're together, you just didn't know their backgrounds. It'd be a challenge for you. And I remember the final itself was against the Bristol Aztecs, who were the favourites. They ran this crazy wing tee system that, you know, it's just a lot of misdirection, and they had good athletes. They had twins who could just do the option and just run track guys. Our focus was on, for the D-line, don't try and make the play, just chop down the guys in front. And the linebackers, we had some backers who could play, who were physical, could run and could play, make a play. That game, we were down in the first half, but we've never been down before, ever. And I'm thinking, as they come off field, what do I say to these guys? You know, you need to pick them up because the challenge is they're in a situation they've never been in. I didn't say anything. Will Bryce stepped up and he gave a speech. And I was like, okay, nice one. he saved me the effort. And he talked about how he felt about the guys, the group, how they came a long way, and that they're not going to go out like this. And we went out and played the second half, and there's two plays that stand out for me. We had them pinned on the goal line. They were like on third and long, and they did a misdirection off the left-hand side, and this guy's running. Now, our safety isn't known for being physical. He could run, he isn't being known. And and you can see the coach on the sideline thinking, this is going to be a touchdown. You know, we're just going through that thing thinking, no. But he went over and he tackled him. And we were like, okay. The game ended all square. You know, we had the old college ruling, you know, from the 25-yard line, one opportunity each. They went first. We stopped them. And we went, and it was fourth down. Fourth and goal it was. Quarterback fumbles the ball. Big A, Aaron, picked up the ball and ran into the end zone and scored. It was crazy. If you ever met Aaron, Aaron was 6'7", 300-plus pounds. I had to stand on tiptoes to hear him speak because he was so soft. He was such a softly spoken person. His mannerism was so soft. But when it came to football, it was like, yeah, okay, I can do this.
That's fantastic.
And we won the game. Yeah, it's just a beautiful story.
So following on from the program Jerry discusses there are things he continues to deliver on in the game now. Indeed, some of those things are what the NFL Academy in London stands for. That is the opportunity for young kids who may never get the chance to play or succeed in life. And on top of that, it's about promoting and living and showing and believing in racial equality.
It's a journey, and it's been a long journey for me personally. And it's been a longer journey for, you know, those who came before me. But for sure, you know, it's being judged because you look different to somebody else, okay? And when you look different to somebody else, you're instantly, they think you're not good enough. So how do you prove to them that you are? You know, growing up, you know, the thing for me, from my parents and my uncles were, you know, you have to be twice as good. And I've always walked with that. And that's why maybe I like to compete so much. So my message to these young people is, you know, you have to do the work. And even when you don't feel like you can do the work, you have to push yourself. And more importantly, when you get the knockbacks, when you get knocked down, how do you pick yourself up and how do you carry on? Because that's a true testament to who you are, who you become. Because similarly like to football, regardless how good you think you are, you're going to get knocked down in a game somewhere, sometime, somehow. How do you recover? How do you pick yourself up off the ground and go again and continue to compete? And that's what it's been like for people of my colour, for black people, is, you know, we're always competing. It seems like we're running uphill just to be seen as equal, which is hard.
What do you think of the academy and the opportunities, given as a player who obviously had to go a different route to professional football, the opportunities now that are going to be for these young men to go to college, some have already gone to high schools, and then to hopefully make it onto the NFL from there. What do you think about just an opportunity that wasn't there when you were playing?
I think it's great, Neil. You know, I think it's great once we can get the kids to buy in. And, you know, one of our things is, you know, we mustn't lose facts of the focus should, it's got to be both education and sports, because we know from our experience that not everybody who goes to the academy is going to make it to a college in the US. And sooner or later, they're going to decide that make football isn't for them, or life gets in the way. Okay, what do they then have to fall back on? But the fact that they can go become better individuals, you know, study and practice American football and all the things that go with it, all the learnings, you know, we try and do via our character development sessions, speaking about nutrition, well-being, you know, how do you become a professional athlete? they have the opportunity to do that before they're 20. And I understand this, 20 is when I started playing. That's my first day. So they have an opportunity to develop into a professional athletes, if, even if just by mindset, and create and make sure that, again, you know, they're in a position that they get an opportunity to go to a college or high school in the US, or even just play for GB. You know, whatever their dream is, that they're ready. You know, it's 3 times a week practice, lifting weights, discussion about nutrition, all those things will help prepare them. So if they go to the US and they're in that system, college or high school system, it's no different. There's no shock to the system like it was for me going from 3 practices per week to 7. No, what, we had 10, 11. Right. So, you know, they're halfway there. Then the adjustment is, okay, terminology is going to be different. Great. Okay, speed of the game is going to be different. Fine. And then being away from home, that's going to be a major challenge. But guess what? You can play the game. You've proven that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be at the college. All you've got to do now is refocus and start the grind again and just, again, put yourself in a position to get the opportunity to go to the NFL. You know, it's there's no given route to the NFL, Neil. Okay, we know this. Yes, you have the great school programs that produce X amount of professional football players, but there's also the guys like Kurt Warners who like packing shelves.
That's the one thing I've learned with this, just doing this podcast, telling people's life stories. Kenny Moore was a few episodes ago, the slot corner, one of the highest paid slot corners in the NFL for the Indianapolis Colts, was watching his high school team playing because he was scared of contact. He was selling popcorn. Now he's one of the toughest defenders in the NFL. There is no tried and trusted route to the NFL at all.
There isn't. But again, the key thing is, got the opportunity and he was ready to take it.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest thing for, you know, these people at the academy, the young people at the academy. Just get yourself ready. So if the opportunity comes your way, you can say, here I am, and take full advantage of it.
Last one, Jerry. So you do get to work with all the teams that come over for the London Games. You and I have seen it full circle. So you've played in the games at White Hart Lane or at Stamford Bridge or at Crystal Palace, and you're kind of looking and thinking, well, there's not many people in today to watch the NFL Europe games. To where we are now with these games sold out at Wembley Stadium and Tottenham Hotspur within minutes. It's an incredible journey. It's an incredible story. Credit to, you know, Alistair Kirkwood and everyone at NFL UK. What do you think the future holds for the NFL in London?
I think it holds a few more wow moments, Neil. I think it's gone full circle where, you know, I, like you say, you know, I was fortunate enough to play professionally, moved into operations where I went from the guy who was just walking to a locker room, all my kit will be there, I'd go out, I'd make it dirty, come back, leave it, and guess what, it'd be there clean next week, to being the guy who made sure that the kit was there. You know, and as you move forward, you think, we've played 20 plus games in the UK. You know, if you think back to 2007, I think many people thought it was one and done, right?
Right.
But we're here, we have a NFL stadium, you know, at Tottenham. I think the future's bright. It's very bright. You know, I think we're going to get a lot more people interested and involved in the sport in the UK, and we're going to come with an infrastructure that's going to support the development of the game, and not only the development of the game from a playing standpoint, but also the fact that the NFL are here to stay, and there's jobs in around the NFL that don't include playing the sport. Because I think one of the things that people are unaware of is that there is a big office in central London. And that we do more than just play the sport. And, you know, I can remember when working in the office, there was about 8 full-timers and maybe 8 seasonal staff. To where now we're up to like 50 plus full-time staff. That's crazy. That's crazy. So the future is bigger and better. More games internationally, fingers crossed, you know, and more excitement for the fans. And again, you look at the demographic of the fans, Neil, how much it's changed from when I was playing.
Yeah.
You know, when I was playing, it was fans who just, you know, who were watching the game in the 80s who got involved, who came down. Now, you got whole families coming down. And that's the beauty about our sport, is that I've invited people to come down and experience it who don't know the sport. And they've come down with their families, you know, and young children as young as 7, and they've had a great day out. They've had a great time from I'm going to call it power party, but it's not called that anymore. I'm going back, right? From the tailgate party to the game, and they've had a great time. And if you think to the future, it's by creating the experience that we've created, we're only building our fan base and our long-term fan base at that, because now our fans are that much younger. You know, when I played, fans were my age and older.
Yeah.
Now they're so much younger, and it's great to see. So we're going to do bigger and better things in London for sure.
Okay, so there's my conversation with Gerry Anderson, absolute giant of the British American football scene, quite literally as well. Let's bring in producer Gary Hayes for the mailbag. Gary, how are you, mate?
I'm all right, Neil. Doing my best Gerry impression there.
No, you can't do it. And you definitely, trust me, Gerry is a man you'd want to take into an alley fight with you. I'm not taking you with me.
He's got that really deep South London nonsense croak on his accent. And I thought I'd try it and I failed.
It was like a more intimidating Phil Mitchell. No one knows. Everyone who's listed in America now has no idea. So just we'll move on.
So should we move on to the mailbags while I'm blushing here?
Go for it.
And get away from myself.
Well, you started it.
Yeah. So we've got 3 questions again this week. Good. You might hear me rustling paper because I've got them written down for once.
Old school.
Yeah. The first one is from Mark Jones, and he's talking about trades. So he says, are we ever going to see blockbuster trades anymore, like the Herschel Walker deal to the Vikings, which set in motion the Dallas dynasty of the mid-90s?
I think what was so special about that trade, and obviously people with an appreciation for the history of the game will remember it very, very well, was that trades were quite rare back then. The fact that so many teams were involved, it sent Eric Dickerson to the Colts, and there was all sorts of, movements off of the trades that ended up with Dallas being loaded and becoming the star team of the 90s. So I think blockbuster trades like that, where you see, and we still see it, where trades where they involve 3 teams. I think the difference now is you don't necessarily need to involve so many teams all the time, because trades are way more prevalent. We see trades every year in the NFL now, much, much more. General managers are willing to give up on players, trade them away, start again, trade them away. You know, even trading away DeAndre Hopkins this past summer. So we may not see like big blockbuster trades that involve, big numbers of teams, but we're certainly going to see big name players get traded time and time again. I think trades are a big part of the NFL now, and as fans, they will delight and frustrate us in equal measure, depending which side of the trade you're on.
I like the drama of having 3 teams involved in a trade. It's almost like moving house and you're at the end of the chain. And you're like, don't let that house fall through because the mind falls through.
Right. You can't even work it all. You know, sometimes the mind boggles. So what did they give up and who gave what to who? That's why I quite like 2-team trades. They're much easier as a reporter when you're telling everybody about it.
Okay. So this is a more straightforward question from Steve Greenwood. If you could change 1 rule, what would it be?
It's a massive rule, and it will never, ever happen now, unfortunately. But I'm quite old school anyway. I think, and they've dabbled with instant replay of pass interference penalties. They've dabbled with instant replay of touchdowns and different things. Instant replay went away and then came back, and I think it's here to stay. I would do away with instant replay altogether. I would just get rid of it. I think in sport generally, we're going too far down the technology route. It's robbing the sport of its passion and drama. I understand, I hear it all the time from commentators. I don't care how many times, how long we have to wait, how many times we see it, we need to get it right. Okay, well, I get that. But you also, your team scores a touchdown and you're not really sure whether to celebrate or not, you know? And it's the same in the Premier League. You know, Garrett, I'm a Liverpool fan, right? So this probably, I'm probably saying this because it comes it comes all too soon after the Everton game and the Sadio Mane offside that wasn't. Even when I was celebrating, I was like, should I be celebrating? Because I don't know if that's a goal. And it's the same in the NFL. I think if players are going to have human error and we're going to be seeing them make mistakes, I can live with the odd officiating mistake. I just think all the drama is being sucked out of the sport by, okay, we're going to go to review and we're going to take a look at this. Well, okay, I've been celebrating it as a touchdown for the last 20 seconds. Now you're going to go and take a look. I've got to wait 3 minutes. Yeah. Even the European Cup final in rugby a little while ago ended with the referee on the radio asking somebody, had time run out when they kicked the ball across the goal line? And he was like, yeah. And he's like, okay, you've won then. And all of a sudden, these guys that have been stood around for 5 minutes started celebrating winning the Rugby European Cup. I just think it's all getting a bit too sanitized. I'd do away with instant replay completely.
Yeah, like you say, it takes the passion out of it. And I think when you look at these fine margins just in any sport, and it's like, oh, his shirt, the wind had blown his shirt offside. It's like, was that really an unfair right. advantage? Because that's what those rules are for. It's not to be so cut and dry.
Exactly. And we look at that in the NFL. It's supposed to be, we're only going to overturn stuff if it's, the actual wording used is, if it's clear and obvious. Well, okay, so then I see them looking at it under the monitor for 5 minutes, or they're looking at the video of it on the TV.
And they're drawing
for
5 minutes. Lines in.
Right, well, then that's not clear and obvious, is it? So just stick with whatever the call was on the field. You should, if it's clear and obvious, you should go under the hood, look at it for 20 seconds, come back out and say, we're overturning that. If you are under that hood for 2 minutes, you in your own mind should be thinking, this is obviously not clear and obvious then, I'm getting out of here. But they don't. It's micromanaging and I don't like it.
Okay, well, on to the last question of the week from Howard Moore. He says, Neil, what in your opinion are the key elements to make some organisations always competitive? Ravens, Seahawks, Saints, Patriots, and some almost always rebuilding, like the Jets, Tampa and Jags. Although I think that's a bit harsh on Tampa this year, right?
Yeah, although they haven't made the playoffs for a very long time, so you could put them in that company until they prove it. There's teams like, so the Ravens, Seahawks, those are good examples. They're all on the same page and they all have the same philosophy and they're all believing in the same things. And I think sometimes the trouble is it becomes a bit of a vicious circle because take the Jets. They've been through head coaches and general managers and they make so many changes. The Cleveland Browns were the same way. That what happens is your general manager and your head coach don't become aligned. So you have a general manager brought on board who didn't hire the head coach that's doing the work right then. You know, that head coach is he's not the general manager's guy. So therefore, they're not on the same page. So they're operating to different timetables. The general manager might be on a 5-year plan to turn his team into a Super Bowl champion. The head coach might have 1 year to win and save his job. There you go. You're not aligned. One's going to take a patient approach. The other one's going to be demanding players right now because he needs to win. So I think the more you can, history does kind of repeat itself. The more you can be on the same page, you know, the general manager of the Baltimore Ravens now, Eric DaCosta, learned at the knee of Ozzie Newsome, the general manager before him. He was in that building. He knew what was required. I think history repeats itself with these teams and it's hard to break the cycle. You need a general manager and a head coach who are on the same timetable, have the same plan, and have the same beliefs. And you'll be surprised how many times that doesn't occur.
Yeah, you say there about the being aligned, the coaches need to be aligned and you know, with the general manager. How much do you think of a lot of that is culture as well, where when you've got two people that aren't necessarily aligned, it must be so difficult to create a culture with a franchise that's got 53 players on a starting roster as well, which must be so important, right?
Yeah, if you feel like if you're fractured at the top, players are going to know it. Yeah, they're going to know it. I mean, we see players talking out about, how teams are run. Players are emboldened, players have the power, the players are the game. If there's not a strong kind of leadership and you feel like a general manager is undermining a head coach, or a head coach is, turning the team against the general manager, I mean, that's just a recipe for disaster. I mean, it really does sound kind of corny, but those teams that are like, we're all in this together, we've all got the same belief, we've all got the same plan, they're the ones that win. I mean, it does work. It's not just a script from a Hollywood movie. So, it's difficult for those ones that are in the doldrums to kind of turn it around.
And speaking of winning, we have a winner on the podcast next week.
We do, yes. So he's a Super Bowl champion. He was a two-time Pro Bowler, outstanding wide receiver for the Green Bay Packers. Greg Jennings is going to join us. Greg's had an incredible career in football, including now going on to be a tremendous commentator for Fox on Sundays on the NFL. He's also turned to a second career as a bodybuilder, and he recently won Mr. Minnesota. So there's some tremendous stories. This is a guy who played with legendary quarterbacks in Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers. He was right in the middle of that awkward transition between the two. And he talks very openly, doesn't he, Gary, about both men?
Mr. Minnesota. Yeah, it was a really interesting interview, and I'm looking forward to editing it and staying up late working on it.
Good man. You are a good man. So my thanks to Gary, again to Jerry Anderson for being part of this week's episode, and for you guys for listening, and we'll be back next week. See you then. This episode was hosted by myself, Neil Reynolds. Our producer is Gary Hayes, while Matt Alabaster is responsible for all of our artwork. Taylor Hayes mixed this episode and also composed our theme music. Special thanks to junior producer Henry Smith and everyone else involved in helping us put this episode together. The Neil Reynolds Podcast is a Highway 61 production for the Reynolds Podcast Network.